So nice to have you back, Colonel.
Thank you very much for inviting me again.
Yeah. Let's get started with what's going on right now between Houthis and Israel. We had Houthis, they have used a ballistic missile to hit a military base close to Tel Aviv. And we had this attack. On the other hand, in Israel, they're talking about there are a lot of discussions between Netanyahu and his Ministry of Defense, talking about they want to attack Hezbollah. It seems the next 2-3 weeks for Netanyahu is so crucial for his power in Israel. And how do you find the whole situation, this attack and what's going on vis-a-vis the conflict with Hezbollah?
Well, the Houthi attack or Ansar Allah attack on Israel that happens last weekend is very interesting. And probably I can show you here a map so that you have an idea of what we are talking about. This was a hypersonic missile that was launched from Yemen up to Tel Aviv. And the missile landed in the neighborhood of the Ben-Gurion airport, probably targeted the power plant, but we don't know exactly. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you have other information. But the issue here is twofold. The first one is that we have, the first thing is that we have an hypersonic attack in the heart of Israel that Israel was not able to intercept. And that's very interesting because, as you have seen on the map, you have currently 3 Navy ships that are around Yemen. They were not able to intercept the missile. And in the landing phase, if you want, of the missile, none of the Israeli system, and namely the Arrow system, which is designed to intercept ballistic missiles, the Patriot missile that is supposed to be able intercepting ballistic missiles as well. And then you have the David Sling, which is not designed for this kind of missile. It's more designed for cruise missiles. And the Iron Dome, which is more designed for tactical missiles, or like those rockets fired by the Palestinians, for instance. But the 2 main systems, the Patriot and the Arrow system, were not able to intercept the missile. The missile traveled the 2,040 kilometer within 11 minutes and 30 seconds. That gives an average speed of 11,000 kilometers per hour, which is extraordinary considering the, technological or capabilities of Yemen, which is obviously not a very rich country. This missile, which is designed by the Houthis as the Hatem II missile, is probably a variant of the Iranian Shekhan missile. And this is, so this was probably, it was designed in Iran, but was probably assembled somehow in Yemen. In any case, we see that the Yemen has this capability. And now it's interesting when we talk about Israel wanting to attack Iran, having war with Hezbollah, with whoever in the Middle East, we can see that just one missile without any decoy was able to hit the heart of Israel. What would happen if Israel would attack Iran? You know, because we can assume that this missile is not the only one that the Houthis have. And it's probably not even the only one that Iran has. By the way, when I mentioned Iraq, you had also the other day, you had the Iraqi resistance who was able to strike Haifa, the port, the Israeli port of Haifa, with a cruise missile. And this is not the first time. The Iraqi resistance was able to hit oil depots in the area of Haifa several times in the past 6 months. Meaning that we see that although Israel is assumed to have the highest technological capabilities in the region, it is not able to prevent Hezbollah drones to overfly the country. It didn't prevent the Hezbollah attack against the unit 8200, this famous signals intelligence facility close to Tel Aviv, by the way, where allegedly 22 officers, Israeli officers, were killed, among which allegedly, there is no proof for that, but okay, we can assume it might be true. I mean, some say it's true that even the head of the unit 8200 was killed. So we see that Hezbollah was able to strike a highly protected facility in the area of Tel Aviv. The Iraqi resistance is able to strike multiple times the oil facilities in the area of Haifa. That's about 500 kilometers flight distance. And the Houthis were not only able to strike the heart of Israel with drones a couple of weeks ago, but is also able to strike Israel with hypersonic missile. So we see that the capabilities of the so-called axis of resistance is dramatically improving, while those of Israel seem to be outdated or unable to address these kind of threats. And at the same time, you have this Israeli rhetoric that they want to strike at everybody, and strike against South Lebanon, strike against Iran. So they are ready to make war against everybody, but at the same time, they are not able to cope with the threats that they are provoking, because that's also a very interesting point. So that's the first aspect of this. This is this inability of Israel of coping with a threat. The second aspect is that we see that the strategic posture of Israel is degrading, because more and more we see that even the West is not able to support Israel effectively. In Yemen, Yemen just downed the 14th MQ-9 Reaper drone, you know, this very expensive, high sophisticated, high altitude drone that is used by the US. And the Yemeni have already downed 14 of them, meaning that these drones, who are protected with the huge electronic countermeasures and all that, they are not able to cope with the technology of the Yemeni. So we see Israel more and more isolated on the international scene, less and less capable to cope with the threats it triggers. And we see, we can even, in addition to that, we see no attempt from Israel try to solve the problem on the diplomatic scene, meaning that they still want to rely on military solutions, while the technology seems always less favorable to Israel. And that's, we are going in a scenario, slowly in a scenario, that Israel, if Israel wants to escalate the conflict in order to escape the situation in which it is, we could well come in a situation where Israel might be totally destroyed. And that a situation that the West cannot afford to allow, meaning that is the West ready to fight for Israel? Even though Israel is still in a trial for the accusation of genocide, and even if the leaders of Israel are under the threat of an arrest warrant for war crimes. So we see that the situation of Israel becomes every day more tricky to some extent. So I think this attack from the Houthis is extremely important for that point, because it sets the limit, not the limit, but it raises the level to which Israel has to expect a threat. And that, I think, is an important, is a very important issue. And I am a little bit worried to see that in the media, for instance, the Western media, in Europe at least, nobody talked really about this this Houthi strike against Israel. The problem is that in the West, we tend to put the dust under the rug, you know, so that you don't see the dust. And that's a little bit the problem. And we have done exactly the same thing with Ukraine. And now slowly we are waking up in Ukraine, waking up in, not yet in Israel, because nobody dares to say, it's forbidden almost to say that Israel is failing. Well, especially in France, for instance, some have tried to say so, and they were considered as making apology of terrorism. So we tend to ignore the reality, but the reality is the reality, and there is a point in which the reality will collide with false narrative. It still starts to do so, but at one point, if Israel is really threatened, then there will be a collision between the narrative and the reality. And I don't know how European countries will react to that. The US, probably they will try to, they have commitment with Israel, and they will probably try to commit troops. But again, I don't see anybody in the U.S., I mean anybody on the military side, the Pentagon, for instance, I don't see any appetite for that. You have politicians with their usual rhetoric saying that they will support Israel and they're committed to support Israel, including with military force. But we don't see the same kind of enthusiasm on the military side. And the idea of supporting Israel through technical means is certainly here, and by using some anti-missile missiles or something like that, that's probably true, and probably with some airstrikes and things like this, okay? But beyond that, I don't see any appetite to put boots on the ground. That was certainly not the case with the Gaza, even if some special forces apparently were committed probably more to assess the situation, in fact, than for taking active part in the operations. But still, we don't see that the Americans are very enthusiastic to put boots on the ground, even for Israel. And I told you, I already told you that with my various contacts with various officers, U.S. officers, I saw none who were so enthusiastic about supporting Israel. First of all, in the U.S. military, you still have this memory of the USS Liberty, this intelligence ship that was attacked by the Israeli Air Force in June 1967. And this attack killed several U.S. sailors. And that remains something that the U.S. military has never managed to swallow. So this is something the Americans know that the Israelis are very keen to ask for support, but they are not ready to support the U.S. You know, this is for the Israeli interest, but not the Israeli are not working for U.S. interest. So it's a one-way street, period. And everybody knows that. And for that reason, certainly politicians do, but military don't see an appetite to engage in such kind of conflict. So we are in such a situation. And when we talk about the idea, and we see that the U.S., by the way, it makes every effort to discourage Israel to attack Hezbollah, for instance, and of course Iran, because they know that if it goes in such a conflict, I mean, Israel was not able to solve the situation in Gaza. And Gaza is a very tiny territory with almost no logistical depth, with limited resources and all that. What will happen if Israel attacks South Lebanon? I mean, it didn't happen. It didn't come out well in 2006. And I don't see that it would go better this time. I mean, I would even suggest that if Israel would attack southern Lebanon today, it would be worse than 2006. And in addition to that, Israel is fighting on three fronts now. They have Gaza, of course. They have this front with the Houthi, which is more strategic level, if you want, but they have also this front with West Bank that they recently opened. Now, opening a fourth front is, in my opinion, an extremely dangerous path for Israel. So, we see that within the and you mentioned the new defense minister, I'm not sure he was appointed. I haven't seen if he was appointed, but nevertheless, Israel needs a replacement for Yoav Gallant. But we see that within the military establishment, there is a strong resistance against Netanyahu. This resistance is probably not an ideological one, because my view is that by and large, Netanyahu, as it regards to the policy towards Palestinians, Netanyahu has a large popular support. And we see that, I mean, the general population in Israel is not against what the Israeli army has done in Gaza. But they are addressing the strategy to, especially when it comes to the so-called hostages or prisoner of war, depending. That's the problem, more than the strategy towards the Palestinians. And here you have different views within the military as how we should proceed with that. So the problem is not the end goal, because I think by and large, the Israeli population is not ready to share their territory with the Palestinians. And I think that remains that way, even if some individuals probably think that we should not do that with extreme violence. Probably we should do that progressively. But at the end of the day, they think that Israel should have the territory from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River. I think that's something which is commonly admitted in Israel, and they don't want to share this territory with Palestinians. I think that's probably widely supported in Israel, with few exceptions. But the problem is more the how than the what. And that's where you have this diverging opinion between the political leadership and the military leadership. It's about the how, not about the what. And and that's the reason why I don't see in the long run any appeasement in the situation. The problem is the short to mid-term, because the short to mid-terms address precisely the whole. And that's also why I think that the more the time goes, the more we are missing a judgment from the International Court of Justice, because this would then help the European countries, probably the US as well, but especially the European countries, to clarify their position towards Israel. And also their position, not just towards Israel, but also in order to advise Israel, because the problem is that Israel is implementing its policy without having any, let's say, contradictory opinion, if you want. Nobody comes and say, well, we continue to deliver weapons, but you have to adjust your policy. Nobody says so. And that's what, in my view, Israel now would need in order to adjust its policy to something more realistic and to something that allows for a substantial dialogue with Palestinians, and not just about a ceasefire. I mean, we have to definitely to go much further. And since the International Court of Justice is waiting for providing its judgment, final judgment, in Europe, nobody dares to address Israel or to counter Israel's policy. And that's why I think at this stage, the ICJ is key in helping Western European countries to define their posture towards Israel, and probably even towards the Palestinians. Although I think most Western European countries are not very favorable to Palestinians, to be honest. They just want to be involved in some kind of genocide. That's what they are afraid of. But they are not. You see that in most countries, you have now very strong movements against Muslim immigration, because it's not just immigration. It's about Muslim immigration. That's what you have in Germany. That's what you have in France very strongly. That's what you have in Italy as well. And that's exactly what you had in UK. Remember these these riots that you had just after a British citizen of Rwandan extraction, a Christian, by the way, a Christian, stabbed three young girls. But then the violence in the UK started against the Muslims, although the guy who stabbed those three girls was not a Muslim. He was a Christian, and he was born in the UK, so he was not an immigrant in the strict sense of the word. So, but we see that this Muslim immigration is affecting the minds of the Western country. I mean, today you have Sweden offering something like $34,000 for those Muslim immigrants that they welcomed in 2016. You know, the Sweden took all these migrants coming from Syria in 2015. Now, those migrants coming from Syria were in fact Islamists. But the way we look at the situation, I mean, for most people in Europe, the problem of Syria was because Assad suddenly became a very terrible dictator and so on. So that means that those who resisted against Assad were Democrats. And that's the reason why everybody welcomed those Syrian refugees. And probably some of them were very nice people, so I'm not saying that. But the problem is that probably a large quantity of them, and we will remember that when we saw those refugees in 2015-16, they were all young males. You had no women and no children and no elderly people. So these guys were in fact those who were hunted by the Syrian government, because they were in fact Islamists and part of these groups close to the Islamic State and Tahrir al-Sham, these extremist Sunni movement. And remember that Syria is basically Shiite. So those guys were obviously people who wanted to topple the government with the help of the West, by the way. And that's the reason why they came in. But now these guys are creating problems because these guys are extremists. And now we have this problem in the whole Europe. And for that reason, and people tend to link these extremists like Islamic State and all that to the Palestinians, and namely Hamas. And I remember having heard, that was back in October last year, that you had a French politician saying that the Hamas attacked France. And he was referring to the Islamic State terrorist attacks of 2015 and 2016 in France. But this reasoning was that Islamic State is an Islamist movement, Hamas is an Islamist movement, so basically Hamas attacked France. This is this simplistic kind of view. And that's a French politician. So we are not talking about somebody on the street. These are the people who are in parliament and all that. So this kind of simplistic understanding of the situation makes that the Western public opinion, although a lot tends to support Palestinians, but I think there is a very, very strong movement against not simply Palestinians, but against all Muslims. And it's a very tragic situation that is based basically on the wrong perception that we have from the conflict in the Middle East. We always see the problem between secular and Muslims. And that's the way people understand the conflict in Palestine. As a result, people don't like Israelis, but the problem is for the Europeans who they hate the most. You know, it's a little bit that, and because you barely see someone who, let's say, is completely favorable to Israel. They are just accepting the fact that Israel fights more evil than they are. it's a little bit that. And it's a very tragic situation where that our media have created, in fact, because they portray this conflict in a very simplistic way. and with the idea that you have good and bad guys, period. And now our media are taken between two fires because the bad guys are the Palestinians. But now we see more and more that Netanyahu is the bad guy too. So, you know, and that's the problem in which the Western politics is entangled into. And that's that. For that reason, I think it's very important that the ICJ comes with a judgment, a clear judgment on what is going on in Palestine. That would certainly help to clarify position. And we need to have clarified position, not to stigmatize Israel, not necessarily, but also to help them to find the right strategy to address the Palestinian problem. Because we know that this situation that we have in Palestine cannot be solved militarily. It has to be solved politically. But for that, we have to convince the Israeli to go politically. The Palestinians have tried to address the issue politically. They had a lot of expectations with the Oslo Agreement, which, by the way, was about 31 years ago. I think it was the 13th of September, 1993. So the Palestinians had huge expectations, but the Israeli didn't fulfill their promise. They didn't recognize the state of Palestine as it was in the Oslo Agreement. The Palestinians accepted to recognize Israel, which was a big step forward, by the way. And today, the Palestinians say that was wrong. That's part of the problem between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas and other movements who say it was wrong to recognize Israel, because Israel has never acknowledged that it took over the territories in 1947, 1948, that it took this territory illegally and not according to the UN Resolution 181. So we see that the problem cannot be solved politically and militarily. And if it has to be solved politically, that means it has to be solved in good faith on both sides. But that includes Israel, because Israel has never been in good faith. They don't want to share the territory of Palestine with Palestinians. So that's a clear fact, period. They never wanted that, and they don't want to. But the problem is that according to the international law, according to the Security Council resolution, General Assembly resolution, and so on, they have to, at one point, they will have to comply, period. So they claim to be the only democratic state in the Middle East, but in fact, they never demonstrated that. And by the way, you cannot be democratic if you are not respecting the rule of law. And the rule of law is precisely the respect of the international law, accepting the international law, and the UN and UN decisions are part of the international law. So this is the idea of democracy is related to the respect of the rule of law. That there is no alternative to that. So that means that the concessions that the West has made to Israel, they could be clarified by the clear position of the ICJ. That's what I said. And I think today I see that as a key element to proceed into this conflict. Otherwise, we will have this government in Israel trying to escalate the conflict because they see that they are not able to cope with the present situation, and so they need to have to escalate the whole thing in order to involve other countries. So that's a tragic of the situation. But the Americans are, I think, conscious of that, and they do a lot of effort to prevent that. The problem is that the U.S. is not listened to anymore. Nobody listens to the U.S. The Ukrainians don't, and the Israelis don't, even though everybody is expecting that the U.S. could solve the problem. So we are in a kind of catch-22 situation. And I don't know. I don't have the crystal ball. But I think this very last hypersonic missile strike of the Houthi, in my view, should make the Israelis think about engaging into wider conflict, because that might very well turn bad for Israel. And that would... I probably a lot of people in the Middle East consider that the problem is Israel. And therefore, no Israel, no problem. You know? This is probably what a lot of countries may think. So in order to avoid an escalation and a total loss of control over the situation, I think it's probably well that the Israelis realize that they have to turn to a political solution and to see. It's interesting to see that in this whole conflict, especially since the 7th of October, but that was certainly the case before, we don't hear much the diplomatic efforts. We see Antony Blinken. But that's probably the only diplomat we are mentioning regarding the situation in the Middle East. It's very interesting. You don't listen to any other type. I mean, the Chinese have tried to, and you listened about the Chinese foreign affairs too. The Russians have tried not to be too much involved. They have other problems today. But we see that you barely hear any European diplomat involved in this situation. There is absolutely, and you don't even listen. You don't even hear about the Israeli diplomat, the foreign affairs minister, and all that. Nobody know them. My view is that we should shift gear and try to abandon the military solution and try to go into political situations. Because if it goes to an enlarged conflict, I think that would be tragic for Israel. That's my personal view, because nobody really sees that the solution can come from Israel. Yeah. And so there is, and Israel makes absolutely no effort to signal that the solution may come from that side. So that's a little bit my point of view. So it's a little bit pessimistic, because I feel that the Israelis have not realized this for some reason. And I feel that the Europe, at least, is not influential enough to press Israel to engage into a political solution. And the Americans, they try to do their best in order to avoid a disaster before the presidential election. I think that's where the priority of the US is now. They're just trying to prevent the disaster. That's exactly what I feel when I see the efforts of Anthony Blinken. So that's a little bit the situation. But as I said again, this missile strike of the Houthis in my view, unprecedented in terms of importance. Imagine that Iran has 10 hundreds of so many of these missiles. You don't need to go nuclear. And in fact, the Iranians demonstrated that they don't need to have nuclear technology because they are even more effective with that, with just hypersonic missiles. If we add to the equation that if the West continues to threaten Russia with long-range missiles, deep in the use of strikes deep inside of Russia, Russia might well share its technology with others. And we have seen also, I think it was yesterday, you had missiles strike of Iraqi resistance against a military base at the border between Syria and Iraq. So we see that the two conflict, the Israel-Palestinian conflict and the Ukrainian-Russian conflict, they tend to have some commonalities. And if anything happened on one theater, it may have an impact on the other theater, and not to the benefit of the West. And that's the interesting thing. And today, if you look at the constellation of countries, we have more and more countries, and especially in the Middle East, who are very keen to abandon the West completely and to stop supporting the West. The BRICS and China offers more perspective for the future than the West. So why would you support somebody who is adverse in your region, who doesn't bring solutions, who just create problems? Because in the last 20 years, the West has just created problems in the region, and problems that affect today even Europe. I mean, we talked about migration and all that. That was prompted by the action of the West in the Middle East. I mean, I think the latest figures on the migration in Europe are that the two main source of migration are Afghanistan and Syria. So these are two countries that we try to destabilize, and they are now creating problem in Europe somehow. Or at least we perceive that so. So we see that the West has just created the problem it is not able to solve today. So if you look at that from a non-Western perspective, you would say, why would you support people who just create problems? Merely, they have created everywhere they have been. They in Israel, they are not people from the region, even if they claim they were here 2,000 years ago. We see very well that is a Western mentality. Most people come from Poland, Ukraine, and all that. Exactly the countries that today create exactly the same problem in Europe, by the way. You see all these declaration about fighting more war against Russia. This comes from exactly the same region as the region from where comes those current Israelis. These are the same people. They're just creating problem wherever they are. The Polish, the Poles, the Ukrainians are adamant to wage war against Russia and all that. And you have exactly the same thing in Israel. And they don't seem to be interested by political solutions. We have exactly the same situation. If you look at this from the a perspective of the rest of the world, you would say, well, why would I support such people? They're only here to create problems. They don't bring solutions.
Shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, after this Kursk incursion, and what do we know about the Ukrainian army right now? And how's the situation with their army, in your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, the situation has just worsened. Just if we look at the front line, if you want, we see that by extending the front line by 150 kilometers or so, the Ukrainians are not able to create a sufficient concentration of force to resist the Russian pressure. So that's one thing. So the decision to engage Kursk was probably not stupid per se, but it was not consistent with the actual capabilities of the Ukrainian forces at this point of time. And as a result, they have simply just extended their line of front, and they have lost additional troops. They've probably lost something like 12,000 people just in the Kursk area since last month, since the beginning of this offensive on the 6th of August. They have lost a lot of tanks and armored vehicles. And they have lost them in place because the Kursk area is not an area where you can use armored vehicles. It's not suited for that. It's more infantry for terrain for infantry warfare. As a result, the added value of tanks in this in the Kursk area was not very big, and therefore the Ukrainians have lost valuable assets in Kursk that they could have used more usefully in the area of Pokrovsk, for instance, or probably behind Pokrovsk to make some kind of counteroffensive force, to prepare a counteroffensive force behind Pokrovsk, for instance. So this is the lack of operational thinking and the lack of strategic thinking in the Ukrainian army, which is explained by the fact that since the beginning of this the Russian military operation in February 2022, we see that the command and control of the Ukrainian army is led by the politics and not by the military, as opposed to the Russians. In Russia, you see that the command and control is very clearly a military command and control type of command. While on the Ukrainian side, we see that a lot of operations have been launched just for the sake of providing a political message or public relation, even if we can put it that way. Remember these different attempts to cross the Dnieper River in Krynki that happened end of last year, beginning of this year. You had various attempts to take this famous Snake Island, which has absolutely zero military value, but it was deemed as important for the Ukrainian leadership, and they lost a lot of troops just for nothing, basically. The same as the attempts for creating a landing in, on the beaches of Crimea with some special force or commando units. They were decimated and destroyed on those beaches, but just for the sake of putting the flag of Ukraine on the Crimean beach. So we don't see exactly the point of these attacks. They just created victims, and these soldiers were just killed for simply nothing, for just having a public relation type of message. But that's all. This was not any operational landing or something that you could have expected, like in Normandy in 1944. Nothing like that. It was very much a simple self self-defined operation. You just land there, period. You just plant the flag and that's it. So what's the purpose? And that's a little bit what we can see with the Kursk offensive. At the end of the day, they probably had more bigger ambitions when they started the operation, and because they noticed that this area was not very strongly defended, and they probably hoped to reach the Kursk nuclear power plant, probably to achieve some kind of deal. I don't know if it was the end goal of this operation, but they had probably more ambitious objectives than just staying in the border area. But they didn't manage to reach the Kursk area. At the end of the day, they never go further than 20 kilometers inside of Russian territory. As a result, this operation was almost self-defeating, because you just take territory which is not very strongly inhabited. Suja, which is the biggest city in this area, has something like 5,000 or 6,000 inhabitants. Most of them have been evacuated, by the way. So what's the gain? You just have a piece of territory that is so tiny that you can barely talk about any, you use that as a bargain chip for any kind of negotiation because it's so tiny. And in addition to that, fighting in this area, because apparently the Kursk area, this tiny piece of territory, is more important for the Ukrainians than it is for the Russians. I mean, I'm not saying it's not important for the Russians, but for the Russians, it's something somehow, one day or another, they will regain. So they are not in a hurry to keep that, to regain that, sorry. While on the Ukrainian side, they consider this piece of territory of strategic value, because they imagine that they could use that as a bargaining chip in the future negotiation. So for them, it's very important. As a result, the Ukrainians tend to invest more resources into the Kursk area than the Russians do. And this has, and that's probably the reason why the Russians are probably not so in a hurry to regain that territory, because in fact, it tends to drag Ukrainian resources in this territory, and those resources are destroyed systematically. As a result, maintaining this Kursk battle, if you want, helps to weaken the rest of the front line. And we see, and that was this article of CNN, which was widely commented in the Western, I mean, in the US press and commentators, but not so much in Europe, by the way, where this article that said that the Ukrainians are outgunned and outnumbered in on the front line, and that basically the soldiers are not in a position to have any kind of success against the Russians, because most of the people who are there are in fact newly recruited soldiers. They received a very, let's say, little basic training before being sent on the front line. So they don't have the experience. They don't have...
Colonel, we had this article yesterday in the Washington Post. It's saying exactly. Ukraine is bleeding out.
This is exactly that. And we see that more and more soldiers are complaining. And that was reflected in this CNN article, by the way, that soldiers are complaining that they are not equipped, not they don't have the right equipment and in numbers and quality to fight against the Soviets, against the Russians. On the other hand, the Russians have consistently improved their capabilities. They have only on the front line, they have people with experience. They rotate them very frequently in order to avoid the fatigue of the battlefield. They are provided with very modern equipment. And this equipment is renewed very constantly by the Russians. They have their production lines work full 24/7, and the Russians have absolutely no let's say shortage of ammunition and equipment, and they are not in a hurry because, again, I repeat, they are still implementing the strategy that was outlined by General Surovikin in October 2022. That means they want to grind down the Ukrainians while protecting their own soldiers. So they preserve their own soldiers while grinding down the capabilities of the Ukrainians. And that's exactly what's happening. And the article you just put on the screen is just reflecting that. This is the operationalization of the word demilitarization that was said by Vladimir Putin on the 24th of February, 2022. This is the process of demilitarization. And regardless of the territory, The Russians are not specifically interested in territory. They are interested in demilitarizing Ukraine because there will be a point in which, regardless of what's left from the Ukrainian territory, the Ukrainians will not be able to defend that territory. And therefore, if we go into a negotiation process, the issue is whether the Ukrainians are in a position to negotiate a position that accepts or renounces to neutrality, because they will have no capabilities anymore, no capacities anymore. So as a result, they will be forced to neutrality. And that's what the Russians are aiming at. And maybe the Russians are contemplating the idea of having an operation in Kherson or in Odessa. That's possible, I don't know. But we see that more and more the Ukrainians are taking troops from the Kherson and Odessa area to put them in the Donbas, meaning that they are even weakening further these areas in the south of the country. So we see that Ukraine is trying to square the circle. but it's failing. And although I think the US would welcome the idea of a negotiation, because the US thinks that this war is lost anyway for Ukraine and for the West. And the only way to get out of this situation without losing too much face would be to have a negotiation. I think that's the US position. Interestingly enough, you don't have this position on the European side. Europeans are still battling for maintaining a situation of war. I mean, pressing Ukraine not to engage into negotiation, and they are still advocating this idea of striking deep in Russian territory and all that. And that's very contradictory, and that therefore we can see that 1 year ago or so, people tended to say that this Russian operation in Ukraine has reinforced NATO and reinforced the European Union and reinforced the West. But in fact, what we see exactly the opposite, that you have a very strong divide between what Europeans and what the US say. And we see that the Europeans are still advocating the idea of having deep strikes into Russia, while you have Patrick Ryder, the spokesperson of the spokesman of the Pentagon, who says that there is no silver bullet to win this war. So the Pentagon says that basically there is no point having the ability to strike deep into Russian territory. At the same time, you have Jens Stoltenberg, who is the Secretary General of NATO, who says that Ukraine should have this capability. And that's very interesting, because as we know, NATO is not an independent organization. You know, what Stoltenberg says is just Stoltenberg. He cannot speak for NATO, as opposed to Ursula von der Leyen in European Union, because as president of the European Commission, she can make decision. Stoltenberg cannot make decision. I mean, the US made decision in the NATO, not Stoltenberg. So Stoltenberg can say whatever he wants, but that doesn't reflect the position of NATO. That's the position of the Secretary General, period. And we see here the discrepancy between what he says and what the US say. And you can be sure that if there is a NATO meeting, NATO will probably more align on the US than on Stoltenberg. Because NATO is the armored wing of the US, I mean, the second armored wing of the US. This is the international armored wing of the US, if you want. So the as a result, we see this division between, on the two sides of the Atlantic, the Europeans, who are more warmongers, and on the other side of the Atlantic, some people who realize that there is no point going further with this conflict, because that would work against Ukraine, in fact. And that's also my position. I think the more you go into this conflict, the more you continue trying to find if you try to find a military solution, this will be totally in favor of Russia. You can take the problem from the side you want, you will come to the same point. And therefore, probably it's the best solution. So probably the European solution is the good one, because at the end of the day, that will completely solve the problem. I mean, by suppressing the problem in its entirety. So that's, but that's the policy of the European Union, which is very strange. But you see here also the similarity of Israel, as we used to discuss before, that we are talking about situations that can lead to the disappearance, the destruction of Israel on one side and Ukraine on the other side. And the more we tend to favor the military solution, the more we tend towards this kind of outcome. And it's very strange to see the inability, especially of the Europeans, because again, I think that although all the criticism we can have against the US, I think in the US, some people have realized this. I'm not sure they're probably not those who surround Biden or Blinken, but some people have realized this, at least. While if you look at Europe, nobody has realized this. And therefore, we still have in Europe this very dramatic and warmongering rhetoric that we should fight up to the last and things like this. And that's what worries me a little bit, because this inability to understand the situation based on facts and not just based on narrative is for me an indication that the Western, especially the European leadership at large, it must be the leadership of the European Union, but also the leadership of individual nations, with the exception of Hungary and others who have clearly realized the danger of the situation. But from others, France, Germany, and all that, we can see that these guys have absolutely not realized the danger they are creating for Ukraine. And Ukraine is, we see more and more resistance within Ukraine itself. And we see that there is a shortage, for instance, now in transport vehicles in Ukraine, because you have more and more those vehicles that are used for transporting troops towards the front who are destroyed by the civil resistance in Ukraine. And in addition to that, as I have mentioned a couple of times, I think, on your channel, there's also a military resistance in Ukraine, itself. I mean, a Russian-speaking or Russian, pro-Russian, let's say, pro-Russian resistance, which is very active in the western part of Ukraine, that destroys ammunition depots and line of communications and railways and things like this. And so, but of course, since the media never report on that, then nobody realize the real situation in Ukraine itself. We tend to have a rosy picture of Ukraine and tend to ignore all the domestic problem that Ukraine is facing. And that's a little bit the probably what explains this kind of erratic type of leadership that we have in Europe, because people don't want or cannot see the reality on the ground. So that's a little bit my take on the situation in Ukraine. But and in addition to that, the West is now unable to fulfill all the demands of Zelensky. And beyond the long-range missiles, we see that the West is not able to provide additional tanks and additional Patriot missiles, for instance, and things like this, because simply these resources don't exist in the West. And in addition to that, since the West is claiming, as did the the former defense minister Wallace, the UK defense minister, he said that after Ukraine, Putin will turn against Europe. So now, should you give all your weapons to Ukraine if you consider that Russia would attack Europe after Ukraine? All these contradictions that are emerging, created by the Europeans themselves, indicate that, in fact, there is little prospect for any kind of success for Zelensky. And when we talk about success, this is this widely claimed but never defined plan for victory that Zelensky has outlined on a couple of interviews without providing any significant details. And some details have been contradicted. I looked at the Ukrainian media, and they are not even very clear about what this plan for victory could be. Apparently, Zelensky doesn't want to provide more details or significant details before having discussed this plan with Biden. I don't know. The fact of the matter is that we hardly see a path for victory for Ukraine. And probably the problem lies in the how you define the word victory. That's probably where we can see the issue, because if we talk about a classical military or political victory, we don't see that in any way in the current situation on the ground. And even politically, by the way, we don't see that. And I don't know what Zelensky has in mind, but it will certainly, if it can call a victory, for instance, having claimed the claiming of taking territory in Kursk, for instance, I can say that's a victory. But the problem is that claiming victory on the Ukrainian side doesn't correspond to a defeat on the Russian side. You know, when the Allies claimed victory in May 1945, that was clearly a victory on one side and a defeat on the other side. But here in the current situation in Ukraine, you can hardly claim a victory on one side and claiming defeat at the same time on the other side. And that's a little bit this conundrum in which Ukraine is. How do they call victory? And even I think I have mentioned that on your channel a couple of weeks ago. Even Lloyd Austin, as he was audited by the Senate Commission of the Committee of the Armed Forces, he was not able to articulate what a victory could be for Ukraine. Nobody knows what a victory could be. As a result, if you don't even know what your objective is, how can you articulate any kind of victory? Or you cannot articulate a strategy if you don't know what the objective is. And that's exactly what we have. So I think a lot of people say today that Ukraine has already lost this war. And it's probably true, but in order to make this more concrete and to make them realize that, probably we should let things go a little bit and to have a very clear and defined victory by the Russians. And therefore, then the Ukrainians will be forced to acknowledge that they cannot just fight with rhetoric. There are facts on the ground and things like that. And probably this could also convince the other European countries, because, as I said before, my concern is that even European leadership has not understood that Ukraine has already lost this war. They hate Putin so much that they are able to convince themselves that there is still hope for victory. But I've never seen any European politician who was able to define exactly what could be victory in Ukraine. So that's where we are.
Colonel, just to wrap up this session, yesterday we've learned that Russia is talking about 2.4 million soldiers preparing to have this type of army. In your opinion, how we can perceive this type of mindset on their part? Because do they really think that the future would be pregnant with larger conflicts in terms of what's going on in Ukraine or even between BRICS and G7? That's why they're preparing for the worst case scenario in their mind. Or it's something beyond that.
No, I think we have to see that more rationally. First of all, when we talk about 2.4 million soldiers, it doesn't mean that all these 2.4 million are under arms permanently. This is just the size of the army. That means that among this, you have a lot of reservists, so you have a lot of people in training and all that. So this 2.4 will be, I would say, almost a rotating strength in that sense. So you will have a permanent army, and then you have reservists that fulfill the gap. But the whole issue is that I think the Russians have understood that we are not going towards appeasement. I'm not sure they think we are going towards war. I'm sure they don't think that, but they see we are not going towards an appeasement. As a result, they need to prepare, because we cannot, if anything would happen, it's very hard to prepare your enemy when you are in a state of war. So you have to prepare that beforehand, and you have people who are trained. You remember those 300,000 people who were mobilized in September 2022. In fact, those people were not new soldiers. They were reservists and people who had been already trained, and so that they could be used to, let's say, support the forces on the front line in Ukraine. But most of these soldiers, by the way, were not sent to the front line. I think out of them, I don't remember exactly the figures, but I think, I may be wrong on that, but I think this is that only 40,000 of these soldiers were eventually sent to the front line after having refresher training and all that. Meaning that these 300,000 people were people who had already been trained. They just needed a refresher training in order to be operational. And most of these soldiers, by the way, were not people combatants. There were people working on the rear area, on communication, logistics, and things like this, but not frontline soldiers. So when we talk about such an army, we have to understand all this, because you need to have people on the front line, but you need also a huge amount of people on the rear as an example, during the operation in Iraq or Afghanistan, the U.S. had what we call the teeth to tail ratio. Teeth to tail ratio is the ratio you have between combatants, is the teeth, to the rear, which is the tail. And this ratio was 1 to 10. That means you had one combatant, I mean, you had 10 people supporting one combatant, basically. And the more sophisticated your army becomes, the more it requires a very strong tail for repair, for maintenance, for logistics, for training, for all these kind of things. And that's probably the increase in personnel that has been decided for the Russian army is also probably linked to that, meaning that we have seen that in Ukraine, you have a lot of new equipment appearing on a battlefield. We have seen a huge an increase of the use of electronic countermeasures, for instance, electronic warfare units, and all that. All these kind of units need to have repairmen, maintenance, and all that. So when you have some guys fighting on the front line, it requires an exponential number of people behind to support the operation. And that explains probably part at least of the increase that has been decided in Russia. So I wouldn't be alarmed so much about this, but this shows that the Russians are taking very seriously all the threats that come from Poland and from Western countries. Remember that Finland, for instance, has opened, I don't remember exactly, I think it was 11 or 13 sites for the deployment of NATO forces on its territory. And you have the same thing happening in the Baltic state and all that, meaning that the NATO presence close to the Russian border has also increased. So Russia has to take this this development into consideration, and having at least the necessary preparation to face a possible increase of tension. And therefore, I wouldn't take this this general increase of the armed forces as an indication of a possible problem, but I would take that as the indication that Russia is taking very seriously the increase of the NATO presence at its border. And this, especially when you see these countries such as Poland and the Baltics, who have an extremely aggressive rhetoric and who may be ready to engage into silly type of decisions, probably the Russians take all that very seriously. And for that reason, they prepare and make sure that they have enough trained troops and enough equipment and enough modern equipment to face any possible degradation of the situation. So that's my view. But I don't take that as an indication that the situation is degrading. I would take that as a precaution measure from the Russians. And this is very usual. The Russians, and when I used to work in strategic intelligence in Switzerland, I had the feeling that Swiss and Russians have something in common. They always try to plan ahead, and they always have redundant, for instance, resources, or let's say try to make their resources very redundant. If something fails, they have an alternative solution and all that. And the Swiss are like this for everything. They double everything or triple communication. Everything is tripled. We had during the Cold War, Switzerland had two or three telephone networks. I mean, that was line networks, right? That was physical networks. But we had two or three in certain region, even three different telephone networks. In case of war, if one would fail, we could switch to the second one or even to the third one. And that's very the way the Swiss understand. And I noticed that it was exactly the same with the Soviets at the time. And the Russians are like this. They double or everything. They try to to plan for additional resource just in case the first would fail, then they have the second one and all that. So I think we have to understand the Russians a little bit in that sense. They are extremely keen in deep planning and keen in anticipating the possible failure of one thing. And if you look at the defense line they have, for instance, the so-called Surovikin line that they had since October 2022 they still have in Ukraine, you can see exactly the same thing. It's built with different lines. If the first one fails, then you have the second. If the second fails, you have the third one, and so on. So it's a layered system. You can look at the air defense system. It's also a layered system with overlaps, so that if one fails, you have the second one that comes, and so on. The same goes with communication and things like this. You have layered systems that overlap each other. So if one fails, you still have the next one, and so on. So this is, it's extremely Russian to try to anticipate possible failure of one aspect and one element in order to have the anticipation, in order to replace that first element with a second one, and so on and so forth. So therefore, I don't, again, I see that with this kind of, if we look at this from a Russian perspective, this increase in forces makes simply just sense. By the way, you have seen that in many Western countries, they talk about developing conscription, for instance. That was the case in UK. They contemplated this idea of developing conscription. You have that in other countries as well, in order to have more people in the armies, because after the Cold War, most Western armies shifted to professional armies that with much less soldiers, more expensive, but less, but also significantly less. And that explains also why the Western armies or Western forces or Western countries are not able to supply everything Ukraine needs, because they, even their own supplies are so short, because that's what happened after the Cold War. You know, that was the idea that now we have peace and therefore we can dismantle our defense system. And now we have seen in several countries, you have thoughts now to restore what we had during the Cold War, I mean conscription and things like this, so that we have more soldiers and then we can develop, I mean France tries to develop its own defense industry and all that. So there is this a similar move in the West, basically. So this decision from Russia looks very spectacular, but in reality it responds to similar initiatives that have already been addressed in the West, and that respond also to kind of mentality that we prefer to be on the safe side for everything, therefore we try to have more than not enough.
Thank you so much, Colonel, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
That was my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.